I'll start by saying a little bit about why I came to write the book several years ago. Obviously, we're in a moment where the left is very weak and doesn't seem up to the task, at least at this point, of confronting the all-out war that is being waged against working people and every other vulnerable group in society. And so several years ago, the situation was pretty similar, and I had been active in the climate movement and a number of other movements for quite a while, and really wanted to figure out what some of the lessons from history were for how we could rebuild the left and build the mass movements that are an essential part of that left. And so most of the book consists of historical case studies of some of the major and most widely recognized movement victories in U.S. history, ranging from the abolition of slavery up through the movements of the 1960s and 70s. And most of the book is not directly about the climate movement, but it's about these historical victories. And then I try to draw some lessons that I think are applicable for the climate movement. Because in spite of the fact that the climate movement and the climate struggle are qualitatively distinct from movements of the past and challenges of the past, I think that there are still important lessons we can learn and apply from those past movements, right? Especially with regard to the relationship between economic power and political power. So I'll say more about that. Three historical cases that I'll go through briefly, and then if there's interest, we can dive into more detail about any of these cases. After I get through these, I'll say a little bit about how I think the lessons apply to what the climate movement is currently facing. So my essential analysis of these victories is that they did not come about primarily as a result of electoral politics or the traditional strategy of progressives of targeting elected officials or lobbying or protesting the institutions of government, particularly politicians, but rather that they came about through the targeting of economic power centers, sectors of the ruling class, which had the power to direct the state to make changes in its policies. So I'm gonna walk through the worker rights movement in the 1930s and then in the United States, which was unquestionably one of the most important victories from the last century or so, the Black freedom struggle in the United States during the 50s and 60s, and the anti-apartheid struggle, which culminated in the early 1990s and helped to bring about the collapse of South African apartheid. And so all three of these movements, I would argue, lead us to some important conclusions about how movements today can win. So I would argue that there are three common ingredients in the success of each of these movements, which remain relevant for today. One is that they did not primarily focus on institutions of government or politicians. Instead, they focused on strategies of mass disruption of business. And this took the form of depriving business, that is to say capitalists, of the essential resources that they needed in order to function. So specifically labor, money in the form of consumer dollars, and the flow of investments into those sectors that they were targeting. So in the case of the worker movement, the Black freedom struggle, and the anti-apartheid movement, the targeting and the strategic disruption of business interests was the first essential piece of the strategy that allowed them to win. Secondly, these movements were all sustained over a long time period and also escalated their pressures over time. In all of these cases, there was a real perception on the part of the elite that the movements were not going to fade away quickly, that they weren't going anywhere, and that even worse, their tactics might escalate and the consciousness of the people involved might radicalize. So if you look at the 30s and the 60s in particular, there's a real fear among the ruling class in the United States that the mass base of each of these movements is moving in a more and more radical and anti-capitalist direction. So that was an important consideration in the decision of each of these elite targets to surrender to the movement or to make major concessions to the movement. And then a third common ingredient in all of these movements is that they singled out key targets within the ruling class that were, first of all, vulnerable to collective pressure, and second of all, that had the power to be able to enforce change on other segments of the ruling class. So the key targets might involve particular companies, particular industries, elites in particular geographic locales. So the singling out of these key strategic targets and the application of sustained pressure to those targets is the third common ingredient among these three movement victories. So if we think first about the 1930s, and specifically one of the most important pieces of the New Deal reforms in the 1930s, which was the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, otherwise known as the Wagner Act. This act effectively legalized the private sector collective bargaining rights for workers in the United States. And it was one of the reforms of the 1930s that was most staunchly resisted by capitalists. It had very little in the way of capitalist support when it was first passed. And then after it was passed, there was several years where its implementation was very uncertain. It was very unclear whether employers were actually going to respect it at all. And it was worker militancy that led, first of all, to the passage of the act in 1935, and then to the effective implementation of the act over the next several years. Now, when we talk about the 1930s, of course, this is a common reference point in progressive circles and liberal circles in the United States, for good reason. But the traditional narrative about the 1930s and the New Deal usually gives a lot of credit to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal liberals in government. It also tends to emphasize the role of election campaigns, both presidential and midterm elections, in bringing into office these reform-oriented Democrats who helped to shepherd these liberal reforms through the halls of government. And I think this narrative seriously misunderstands the actual dynamics that were at play, the actual dynamics that allowed the workers' movement to win what it won. Now, the first major component was, again, the disruption of business directly by workers, employed workers often operating in collaboration with unemployed workers. And at each step of the reform process throughout the 1930s, we see dramatic upsurges of worker militancy, which directly contributed to the decision of government policymakers and eventually economic elites as well to make concessions to the working class in the form of unionization rights. So if we go back to the beginning of the 1930s, one of the pieces of this story that is often overlooked, this is even before FDR was elected in 1932, there was a major wave of organizing and strike activity in the U.S. coal sector. The coal sector between roughly 1929 and 1932 was a major center of organizing and collective action. This was not primarily happening through the sponsorship of John L. Lewis and the United Mine Workers, right, which was the union that included some of the coal workers in the country. But big parts of that industry were still non-unionized in the late 1920s. The 20s had been a period of dramatic defeat and decline for the working class in the U.S. So by the end of the 20s, only about 10% of the workforce is unionized. And the coal sector, which was relatively well organized, had also been really decimated by the employer offensive, which followed the First World War. So at the end of the 1920s, communist organizers formed a group called the National Miners Union, and they succeeded in organizing coal workers everywhere from western Pennsylvania all the way down to Alabama. And this really happened under the radar, right? And they went on strike, too, in very large numbers. And this perception on the part of the ruling class that this was going to continue and escalate and radicalize led in large part to the 1933 legislation that the Roosevelt administration signed, the National Industrial Recovery Act, which contained an important clause about the right of workers to unionize. And that's often cited as one of the first important moments in the unionization of the 1930s, this government legislation that at least on paper guaranteed the right of workers to unionize. But with that reform, one of the things that usually is overlooked is the role of workers' own collective action and collective militancy in pushing the government to do that. After that point, in 1934, there's a much larger wave of worker strikes all across the economy. There are major strikes that essentially amounted to general strikes in three places, in the San Francisco Bay Area, in Minneapolis, and in Toledo, Ohio, in 1934. And they're just three of the roughly 1,900 strikes in the course of 1934. And those strikes lead pretty directly to the U.S. Congress's passage of the National Labor Relations Act in the middle of 1935, which FDR then signs. After the act was passed and signed into law, as I said before, its implementation was still very uncertain. Employers across the board were essentially just ignoring it, refusing to obey it. And it took another major wave of worker organizing and worker withdrawal of their labor to force employers into a position where they agreed to the implementation of the act. And they actually invited the National Labor Relations Board, which had been recently created under the act, they invited the NLRB into their workplaces to help organize the workers, to conduct NLRB elections. So this was a dramatic about face by an employer class that up until about 1936, 1937, had staunchly refused to even recognize the National Labor Relations Act and the right of their workers to unionize. The key moment in this, the most famous moment in this worker upsurge, were the sit-down strikes in General Motors factories between the tail end of December 1936 and February 11th, 1937. So for 44 days, workers in Flint, Michigan, and they were joined by workers at a number of other General Motors plants, physically occupied their factories, right? There were hundreds of workers physically occupying their factories in Flint alone. And the police and the company were unable to dislodge them without risking serious damage to the company's property. And GM, by February of 1937, surrenders to that action and agrees to let the United Auto Workers organize within their plant. So that's the birth, essentially the birth of the United Auto Workers as a union. That victory over General Motors, that strategic targeting of General Motors as kind of the lead force of U.S. capitalism, the pinnacle leader of U.S. capital, led after February 1937 to the unionization of most of the other mass production industries. So it immediately paved the way for the unionization of the steel industry in spring of 1937. And this is before the Supreme Court had upheld the constitutionality of the 1935 Act. Right? It was widely expected that the Supreme Court was going to overturn it, but they ended up upholding it in April of 1937 on the heels of these major victories in the auto and the steel industries. It was clear that the movement wasn't going to fade. As I said, there was a real fear by employers that it was going to go in the opposite direction. It was going to continue radicalizing, and that the workers' occupation of the factories might actually presage the worker takeover of the industry itself. Right? And that kind of idea was circulating widely in the workers' movement at the time. So the employer's decision to cut their losses and concede the right of workers to unionize was a response that sought to limit the damage to their class interests. And that's what enabled the effective implementation of the National Labor Relations Act, at least for a time. Starting in the 40s, it would be dramatically curtailed and whittled away to the point that we see today. 90 years later, the NLRB has really ceased to be a robust, progressive force enforcing workers' rights. Right? And I would argue that the major reason for that, in addition to the employer's class war against workers, has been the labor movement's de-radicalization. The labor movement in the U.S., it's no secret, has become much less militant and much less powerful than it was in the 1930s. And it's only under those conditions of threat and of fear of something worse that capitalists concede to any major reform in a progressive direction. If we go forward to the 1960s, if we look at the Black movement of the 1960s, the civil rights movement, or what is more properly called the Black freedom struggle, because it was about more than just civil rights and civil liberties. It was, had a strong economic component as well. There were many socialists and anarchists and communists who participated. So the Black freedom struggle of the 1960s, the early 1960s, that is, culminates in the passage of this federal legislation in 1964 and 65. The most famous example is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The traditional narrative about how the Civil Rights Act was passed is very similar to the traditional narrative about how the New Deal reforms of the 30s were passed. The narrative tends to emphasize the role of the John F. Kennedy administration, the Lyndon Johnson administration, and the role of the Democratic electorate in the North. And the conventional wisdom usually says that this reform was possible because nonviolent Black people protested in the South in places like Birmingham, Alabama, and other cities and towns across the South. And they were met with vicious, violent repression from the authorities. People like Bull Connor, the notorious police chief of Birmingham, Alabama, in the spring of 1963. And the scenes in the news of Black people being attacked with dogs and fire hoses then activated the liberal white electorate in the North to pressure their Democratic politicians to intervene in the South to enforce desegregation. And then the conventional wisdom continues by arguing that the Civil Rights Act of 64 was made possible because of that federal government intervention in the South, and then the legislation at the federal level that was enabled by that victory in Birmingham in particular, but in other places as well. And as with the 1930s, I think that conventional wisdom gets the real dynamics dangerously wrong, because it attributes agency and power to liberal white voters in the North and the federal government, when in reality, most of the electorate by 1963, 64 was actually not on the side of the Black protesters in the South. The John F. Kennedy administration went 28 months without introducing any sort of civil rights legislation. It was only on the heels of the Birmingham confrontation in April and May of 1963 that Kennedy finally decides to submit civil rights legislation to Congress. If we look closely at places like Birmingham, where we see these really decisive confrontations that lead to the legislation in 64, the root of the movement's power was not in their ability to attract the sympathy of white allies in the North. The root of their power was the ability to exert direct pressure on sectors of the local and national business elite. And this was especially in the form of consumer boycotts. So the 1930s are an example of the withdrawal of labor power leading to government reform. The 1960s, the early 60s, are an example of consumers using strategic boycotts against key targets to force progressive reform at the level of government. If we go to Birmingham in April and May of 63, the sectors of the white power structure in Birmingham who were most eager to concede to the movement by early May were the downtown merchants and retailers and business owners whose businesses had been disrupted by this five-week boycott with all of the marches and the sit-ins, which dramatically disrupted their sales and their profits, right? They dramatically reduced not just Black consumption in downtown, but also white consumption, because white people didn't want to venture near the downtown to buy anything while these protests and boycotts were going on, organized by the Black movement. And so the head of the local chamber of commerce, a guy named Sidney Smyer, was actually the key force within the Birmingham elite who argued for conceding to the movement in the form of integrating Birmingham public accommodations and businesses. And it's the economic elite that then forces the political elite within the white power structure in Birmingham to agree to integration. So people like Bull Connor and the rest of the police department, the political power structure, are dragged kicking and screaming to concede to racial integration. And it's because the economic elite forced them to do that, because they were subjected to the sustained and escalating pressure from the movement. So Martin Luther King Jr. later that year reflected on what had enabled the success of the movement in Birmingham. And he said to an interviewer, that the political power structure listens to the economic power structure, which is essentially a materialist analysis of political power that largely coincides with the kind of analysis that anarchists and Marxists had long put forward to explain why government behaves the way that it did, right? It's the ruling class, the economic elite, that essentially determine the actions of the state. And that's essentially the analysis that King came around to, and that the movement as a whole recognized and was able to develop a strategy around. So it wasn't just King, that was a collective insight that organizers in places like Birmingham developed and realized, and they've left that lesson for us today. If we look at the movement against apartheid in South Africa, the central source of resistance to apartheid was, of course, among Black South Africans in South Africa itself. The labor movement and the African National Congress, there was, of course, ferocious resistance to apartheid lasting decades. But when it comes to the solidarity movement in the United States and elsewhere, the movement again, focused largely on trying to disrupt business in the form of withdrawing consumer dollars and depriving corporations in South Africa of the investments that they needed. They singled out key corporate targets. The banks were a major focus of the movement starting in the 1960s. Organizers went after banks to try to get them to deny credit to South Africa and to pull their operations out of the country. And again, we see that the victory over one or a handful of those particular targets set the stage for much broader change. In 1985, Chase Bank, Chase Manhattan Bank, today JP Morgan Chase, agreed to restrict credit to the South African government. This was a major blow to the apartheid regime. And after Chase announces that, all of these other banks then jump on board and likewise refuse to continue extending credit to the South African government. So this was another case in which targeting a particular corporation that was extremely powerful and also vulnerable to activist pressure helps to pave the way for major political change. One of the most important ways that the anti-apartheid solidarity movement did this was actually working through the institution of local city government. City councils all over the country began to pass these ordinances that agreed to boycott the goods of companies that were operating in South Africa. And this was even more significant than the university and church-based divestment movement that tends to get more of the attention. But it was the municipal-level boycotts through city councils that really scared the corporations enough to withdraw their investments from South Africa because they didn't want to lose out on all of that municipal-level business in the United States. So if you look at correspondence between CEOs and State Department officials in the 80s, that's what they're saying, that we are really scared about these municipal boycotts. We don't want to sacrifice that business. We would rather pull out of South Africa, which they then did, and that exerted a major influence on the South African government and eventually the collapse of apartheid in the early 1990s. So what are some of the applications for the climate movement today? Now, it goes without saying that it's not possible to simply mechanically reproduce the victories of yesterday. Every movement looks different, every set of circumstances looks different, and the climate movement certainly faces a number of challenges that are different from what these other movements faced, and in some ways, much more difficult to find answers to, right? The scale of the change that we're talking about is much broader than in the case of, say, the anti-apartheid movement. But I think that some of the essential lessons that organizers in those movements recognized are also applicable to the climate movement. So if we go back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight, or the insight of the movement, rather, in 1963, that the political power structure in society listens to or obeys the economic power structure. There are lots of ways in which we see examples of that dynamic on an almost daily basis today in the United States and other capitalist societies. So how might the climate movement apply some of these lessons of earlier movements, the disruption of business, the need to sustain a movement over a long period of time to force elites into conceding, and the singling out of particular elite targets as part of a larger strategy for winning changes. Now, if we go back to Trump's first term in office, Trump, it's important to remember, came into office promising to revive the U.S. coal industry, and yet, over the 4 years of his first term, the coal sector in the United States declined more rapidly than in any four-year period in U.S. history, and actually any four-year period in world history. there was more coal-fired power plant capacity that was retired between 2017 and 20 than at any other four-year period in world history. This is in the United States. But that four-year period comment applies to the entire world, actually. So Trump was, his power to resuscitate the coal industry was very limited. That's the key point here, that in spite of everything that he tried to do to prop up that industry in the U.S., he was unable to do it. And the coal sector continued to decline, right? Not as fast as it needs to, but it did decline. And, you know, a number of mainstream sources like the New York Times have recognized this. What they tend to leave out, though, if you look at the reporting in the Times, for example, they tend to leave out the importance of the anti-coal movement in accelerating this decline of the coal sector. They say that coal's decline was mainly due to the growth in fracking, the natural gas boom, and to some extent the growth of the renewable energy sector. And that's true to a large extent. But the movement, the anti-coal movement all across the country, in hundreds of different locales and states across the United States, played an essential role in helping to accelerate that decline of coal by blocking the construction of new coal-fired power plants. The movement successfully blocked over 100 planned coal plants over the past quarter century, and forcing other plants into early retirement. And if we look at the United States as a whole, state by state, we see that in places where the movement was especially strong and well-organized, they were able to make greater inroads in the fight against coal than in places where the movement was weak or non-existent. And so that regional variation is very important. It wasn't just market forces that undermined the coal sector. It was also the role of hundreds of different small, primarily small, local organizations. We're not really talking about the big green organizations like the National Resources Defense Council and others. We're mostly talking here about local organizers and state-level organizers. And so the movement's victory, the movement's partial victory against the coal industry is something that we need to really take into account as we think about what we can do today as a climate movement and how we can continue to try to limit the production of fossil fuels and the consumption of fossil fuels as a way of trying to contribute to the decarbonization of the economy. Now, we as a climate movement are obviously not winning today by any measure, but there are important victories from the last couple of decades that I think we can point to and take some important lessons from. These victories over coal, and then to a lesser extent, victories over some of the oil and gas company as well, point to the vulnerability of polluters. Despite everything that the Trump administration is currently doing, and despite the fact that the oil companies like Exxon and Chevron are making these record profits the last several years, the oil companies and gas companies remain vulnerable to the climate movement. And I'm not going to delve into all of the things that the climate movement could be doing or in many cases is doing, but I'll just say that I think that the movement is continuing to pursue many of the same strategies that enabled that partial victory over coal in Trump's first term. They're organizing protests, of course. They're organizing legal challenges, working through the legal system, which isn't the most exciting form of resistance, but it does make a big difference, and it does make the industry concerned about the potential legal defeats and their implications. And they're also targeting the financial sector. So the anti-coal movement has long targeted the banks and insurance companies that help to enable the fossil fuel extraction and burning. And that's been a promising strategy as part of a larger strategy against the fossil fuel industry. And so I think that we need to expand upon that, strategy and also continue to learn some lessons from those great movements of the 20th century, which give us clues about how we can take on these capitalist industries that are so destructive and that may seem completely impervious to our pressure. It is possible to defeat these industries and to force them to do things that they don't want to do, to force other sectors of the ruling class to confront those parasitic sectors like fossil fuels, and to force government to join in that effort to regulate and constrain or even abolish those industries. So I think I'll leave it there, and folks have questions or comments or ideas, organizing experiences that you would like to share, please go for it. Yeah, thanks for that question. So polluters have obviously long tried to pit workers against environmentalists. And one of the things that that narrative about workers or jobs versus the environment tends to leave out is the fact that we have a very rich tradition of working class environmentalism in this country. There's things that have been written about that in recent years. Workers don't have a natural interest in siding with polluters. But it's definitely true that we do have divisions within the labor movement, and certainly divisions between the labor movement and, you know, the professional class, like you said. And we need to find ways to try to bridge some of those divisions. I think we've started to see some examples of this in some of the coalitions between organized labor and community organizations, not so much in the high polluting industries, not so much in the coal or oil workers, for instance, but between some of the other sectors of organized labor, like healthcare and education workers. And I think when we talk about just transition from fossil fuels and we talk about building a labor climate movement, we need to remember that the labor movement is so much broader than just the workers in the construction or extraction industries or the pipeline industry. The labor movement is much broader than that, and all working people have a direct stake in the transformation of our economy. All working people are affected by the economic consequences of the climate crisis, maybe more than anything else. And this is something that I think we're just starting to reckon with, is the extent of economic devastation that the climate crisis is going to bring in its wake. And this is going to dramatically accelerate in the coming years. So there was a study published last year that estimated that the economic cost of climate change within the next quarter century is going to come to $38 trillion annually. It's just annually, $38 trillion. And so who is going to bear those costs? It's obviously going to be working people who bear most of those costs in, you know, a dozen different forms, right? All of the ways that prices are going to go up and working people will bear the brunt of inflation, the way that prices for housing and food and a lot of other things are going to skyrocket because of climate destruction. And so I think that that's one place where we have the potential to form labor community coalitions, is fighting for economic protection from some of the consequences of climate change. Organizing against other more visceral things like extreme heat in the workplace, right? We already have workers around the world dying in large numbers from extreme heat, and that's going to get much worse. It's true in the United States as well. And so that's one reason why organizing the workplace is so important. But it's a big question, and I don't have the magic answer to how we unite labor and community. I'd love to hear if anyone else has ideas on that question. So large institutions have enormous power to cut the demand for fossil fuels, which is one of the key things that we obviously have to do. One of the points about our current context that I failed to mention is that, yes, the Trump administration is trying to do everything it can to maximize the burning of fossil fuels. But at the same time, we have all of these ostensibly liberal and moderate institutions like universities, like businesses, like the financial sector, businesses that like to, you know, talk about things like corporate social responsibility, and university administrators who have a reputation as being more or less liberal, are essential collaborators in the Trump administration's agenda. And one of the ways that, one of the numerous ways in which they do that is by continuing to burn fossil fuels. So these institutions that consume fossil fuels and that invest in fossil fuels do exercise very significant leverage in the marketplace if they decide to use it. So for a university, for example, to stop purchasing oil or gas or coal, if it's a large university in particular, like mine, the University of Massachusetts, you know, we have tens of thousands of people. We consume a ton of fossil fuels. We're the largest public sector source of carbon pollution in New England. And reducing and then eliminating that consumption can make a big difference. So I think it's educational institutions, it's corporations and employers of all kinds. You know, the federal government is just one of the key actors here that helps to determine energy investments in the United States. All of these other institutional enablers of fossil fuels also need to be targeted, both because they consume fossil fuels and because they invest in fossil fuels in all kinds of ways, both direct and indirect, through stock holdings, through the banks that they use, the insurance companies or the asset managers that they use. State pension funds, I think, are another crucial institution to target. They control trillions of dollars in assets and are, of course, heavily invested in fossil fuels. I'll mention that state and local government is another place where there's significant potential for making some inroads against fossil fuel industries. And one of the reasons why we can be sure that that matters is that the federal government is trying so hard to block state and local governments from passing laws or regulations that, in their words, discriminate against fossil fuels. So the federal government is trying to revoke California's ability to set its own emission standards. The federal government's also currently trying to nullify the legislation in places like New York State, which tries to make fossil fuel companies pay monetary compensation for some of their pollution. So that's a step toward something that we might call reparations, loss and damage. The bills that try to make polluters pay, which is kind of the unifying framework that these bills have taken up around the country. In Massachusetts right now, we have some make polluters pay legislation. And I think one of the reasons the industry fears that so much is that they see it as a very dangerous precedent to set. The idea that fossil fuel polluters could be held accountable for some of the damage they've caused, they fear that that's really gonna be a slippery slope or a Pandora's box of problems that then get opened up. Because if society accepts the idea, if government starts to accept the idea that polluters owe something to society for the damage they've caused, there's no telling how far that can lead. And so I think engaging in those fights right now is going to be really important. As much as I dislike most of the state and local politicians that I know, I think there are some opportunities for resistance at that level. Yeah, it's a really important question. You know, of course, we don't just want to replace all of the fossil energy with renewable energy. We also want to conserve energy and limit energy usage wherever we can. And the data centers, which are now being constructed to enable artificial intelligence and all of the other services of the IT industry, they are major consumers of fossil fuels. And some of the coal plants that are still in operation are having their retirement dates delayed. So we're actually going the opposite direction, and it's being justified by the need to service these data centers, which consume awesome amounts of energy. New gas plants being scheduled for construction based on that same rationale. So the data centers are a huge consumer of energy. I think that there's some resistance within the IT sector about, you know, socially, environmentally conscious employees who are upset about that. I'm not sure, you know, how consequential that labor resistance is going to become. I do think that in some of the mainstream discussion, the relative importance of those data centers gets a little bit exaggerated because they're still, they are big polluters, but they're still a relatively small percentage of the total economy, right? If you look at all of the different sectors that contribute to carbon pollution, you know, it's industry across the board that consumes vast amounts of fossil fuels. It's not just the data centers, but they are a big source of it. Thank you, everybody. I think we're about out of time. Thanks.